I have written for arguably the top magazines in the world. I've written for The New Yorker. I've written for The New York Times. I've written for The Washington Post magazine. And I struggle every month to make my bills.
Welcome to Money Honestly, I'm Lionel Foster. Imagine for a moment that you are a writer. You just published your very first book. One day after its release, you find out the New York Times loves it. Bazaar, Elle, and Forbes interview you. The Atlantic's review has an exclamation mark in the headline. Your debut is already a landmark. From now on, few will explore the subject you wrote about without referencing your work. But that might or might not mean much financially. How is that even possible? And how would that sit with you? Elizabeth Evetts Dickinson is the author of the new book, Claire McArdle, The Designer Who Set Women Free. She's also a friend of mine and was previously my boss. In this conversation, we talk about how much it might cost to follow a passion, how Claire McArdle was able to navigate art and commerce at the same time, and developing a language for the things that don't have a price tag. Elizabeth never oversaw any of my annual reviews, so we used this opportunity to conduct one 17 years after the fact. Elizabeth, welcome to Money Honestly. Thanks for joining us.
Lionel, it's great to be here.
All right. So what is your money origin story?
Well, I grew up in your sort of classic white middle-class family. It was me and a brother and a dog and a mom and a dad. And my dad was a professor. He taught at a women's college in Virginia. And we had this kind of idyllic setting. We lived right on the edge of that campus. But I grew up always understanding that there was a precarity to our financial situation. You know, we were middle class, but we weren't solidly middle class. We came from grandparents who really, you know, struggled. And we were just starting to climb that ladder, I think, of that classic myth of the American dream, that if you just work hard and you put in your time, it will only keep getting better. But as a kid, I always understood that one small catastrophe could send us tumbling back to a place of financial risk. There was a precarity to it, I think. And, you know, having a father who was in academia and a mother who worked on and off, mostly in arts administration, I also got this message subtly and explicitly that when you do what you love and when you follow a life of the mind or the arts, that means you're not going to make a lot of money. So I think I grew up understanding both that I was meant to do better than my parents, because that was sort of the line everyone was fed in that generation, but also that being someone who kind of tipped toward wanting to be a writer meant that I would probably live my whole life not having a lot of money.
How old were you when you became aware of that financial precarity?
I was young. I can't remember a specific moment, but I remember the idea of, well, we don't have money for that, was a line I heard, which was interesting because I also had a mother that was very much tied into that American dream of keeping up with the Joneses. So she was really dialed into this idea that what she wore and what we had in our home and how she decorated and entertained was important, and it was a marker of success. And so I also, at an early age, understood that my mother's desire to play that role outpaced my father's salary as a professor. Yeah.
What was it like being a little kid with a big brain trying to make sense of all this?
I always felt like growing up, we had a couple of unspoken realities in our household. And one of them was absolutely around money. It sort of was this elephant in the room. And I was the kid that wanted to point out the elephant, which isn't always the greatest place to be. But it really did make me wonder why we were living a life that wasn't correlating with what I understood to be our budget reality. Both of my grandparents, both sets, lived through the Depression. But I remember my maternal grandmother was the one who saved money in envelopes. So anytime we wanted to go on a trip or anytime she wanted to buy us a present, there was a little envelope with our name on it. And she would save even pennies. And she carried this sort of Depression era reality around money. And I think I gravitated towards her a little bit more than my mother because there was a structure to what she was doing. Mm-hmm. My parents never talked about financial literacy. I don't think I was a child of the 70s. I don't know that many kids my age were getting lessons in how to budget. But I really didn't. I understood money was really important and it was going to affect my capacity to do things in the future. But I didn't have anyone really telling me how to manage it. And I looked to my grandmother as a sort of model. And what I understood was you had to work really hard, you had to work a lot, and you had to budget and make these little piles that hopefully would add up to something that allowed you to do what you wanted to do.
What do you do for a living?
I am a writer. So I did not heed the implicit idea that writers don't make money and you shouldn't do it. I've been a journalist for 20 years, which is how you and I met. I have really had these two minds, this type A personality that's been very budget conscious throughout my life. And then this other kind of big, big hope that I get to follow my curiosity and be able to tell stories for a living.
Speaking of following your curiosity, I am very fortunate to be catching you at what seems a pivotal moment in your career and in your life. You're the biographer of a hugely important, but too little thought of, and you're fixing that, fashion designer from the early 20th century named Claire McArdle. Your book came out just within the past few weeks. What is that like?
Because this is a money podcast, I'm going to focus on the monetary side of it because I think it's fascinating. There is still this myth in America of the published author. So on the one hand, I am so happy to have written this book. I love nothing more than spending my time researching, going down rabbit holes of ideas and trying to put together a story. McArdle's story felt very important to me because she is effectively the most important fashion designer that you've never heard of. She invented much of what hangs in our closets today, much of what we wear. And in her story, I also was curious in, like me, she was born in Frederick, Maryland. I was born outside of Roanoke, Virginia. She grew up with brothers. I grew up with a brother. She wasn't wealthy. She was well off, but not wealthy. And she would go on to effectively pioneer an entire industry in the 1930s and 40s. And I was really interested in how a woman who was very creative, who had ideas and a mind of what she wanted to see happen in the world, I wanted to know how she did it financially, because at the time, a woman couldn't even open up her own bank account. It's only within my lifetime that women have been given the right to open a line of credit. So when we think about finances and we think about what it means to be a woman, and then you layer onto that a woman in a creative profession, it's no small feat that Claire McArdle got her name on her own label, became a partner in her garment district firm. And my book really wanted to explore not only her pioneering inventions, but how it is that she did it. Because I'm looking for those models. I'm looking for ways to understand how to do what the poet Rita Dove eloquently said, hold on to that innermost creative fire while negotiating the daily commerce of living. And man, it gets harder every day.
That's such an apt question. How do you negotiate the daily commerce of living? I want to situate us a bit because I think McArdle has a lot to teach everyone. She was born, if I remember correctly, 1905.
Yes.
Yeah. Died around, was it 1957?
Close, 1958. So she died young. 58. She died at 52 from colon cancer. So she died really at the height of her career in a lot of ways.
I recently finished reading your book. It's great. It's hugely informative. I'll give a capsule version so people know why to appreciate McArdle, and then I'll kick it over to you. So my understanding is this is at a period, she grew up in the fashion industry at a period when the U.S. was very much looking to Paris and haute couture, taking its tips from there, stealing, outright stealing, putting people on boats for weeks, sending sometimes women to these fashion shows. They would have to memorize the designs they saw and then maybe run out, squirrel away in a hotel or phone booth, jot down the sketches, maybe send them back by wire to the U.S. But the U.S. was copying France, and McArdle was one of the biggest influences in saying, we have American ideas, American ways of living. They need to show up in our clothes. Give women pockets, for God's sake. Give us clothes that we can live in. I shouldn't need to go to work in one thing, have to run home, change for an early evening event, and then possibly change again for something in late evening. I am multifaceted. I need clothes that can accommodate all of that.
That is a great encapsulation. She went to New York starting in the 1920s. She studied at what is now Parsons. And it was really fascinating in my research to appreciate what it meant to be a woman living in New York in that time. It was hard to be single. There weren't a lot of places for a single woman to live in the city. Most hotels wouldn't rent you a room because you were thought to be of ill repute if you did not have a spouse. And so watching her navigate the realities of just the day-to-day life, and then you layer on top of that a desire to really start to chip away at formal dress codes. This is a time when women were really starting to enter the workforce en masse. They were getting jobs as secretaries and working in offices, and there was nothing to wear. Like there wasn't an attire for a career woman at the time. And there was a lot of debate about what women were allowed to wear and not allowed to wear and how they should dress. There were formal dress codes at businesses, but there were also municipal dress codes written into law, vice law and others, that said a woman wasn't allowed to wear pants in public. You could still get arrested for wearing pants. When McArdle was a teenager, you couldn't go on a public beach with bare legs. You had to wear wool swim stockings. And so when you put what she created, which is she made mix and match separates, which is the foundation of American fashion today. She made casual, beautiful pockets in dresses that you could wear to work, but you could also throw on some jewelry and wear it out at night. It seems so obvious today, but in context of that time, what she did was entirely revolutionary. And it was entirely about outfitting a woman to have freedom in her life, to have autonomy, and to be able to move through the world comfortably so that she could have what Claire called this clothes problem solved. And then she could get on with her life and do what she wanted to do.
I don't know much about women's clothing, but about, I want to say it would have been about 12 years ago, not long after I moved to DC, I had a friend at work named Serena, and she was just so happy because on one particular day, she was wearing a dress that had pockets in it. And it was a beautiful dress. So that piece alone I could appreciate. But she kept going on and about, and look at these pockets. I can put my hands in it. I could put anything in these pockets that I want. And she made it clear to me that that's still relatively rare today. They often don't give women pockets. And I go, that's insane. How are you supposed to live like this? What do they make your clothes like a prison? And so after your book came out and we were scheduled to talk, I texted Serena and said, you have to read this. Because of you, I get how important Claire McArdle was. And this is amazing.
Well, I mean, to your point, even to this day, when you say to a woman, I love your dress, nine times out of 10, she'll say, and it has pockets, if it has pockets. In fact, The Atlantic magazine just wrote a review of this book, and the headline is, it has pockets, right? And I write in the book about why it is that it's still so hard to get pockets. I write about how Claire had to fight to put pockets in clothes. It's very much goes to a societal and a cultural bias about what women are supposed to be and do. And we think it's just an oversight. It's not always an oversight that women's clothes are not practical or functional or have pockets. You know, the other thing about pockets that Claire understood is that clothes are psychological. How we feel and what we wear can dictate our whole day. And if you're comfortable in your clothes and you forget you're wearing them, but you feel good in them, then you're going to have a better day, frankly. And we've all been in a place where we've worn the wrong thing or had an outfit that didn't feel good. And we spent time worrying about how we felt in those clothes rather than being in the moment. She understood that pockets weren't just for holding things. They were a place to put your hands when you were anxious or nervous. They were a place to kind of look cool. You look kind of effortlessly cool with one hand in your pocket. And so what I really came to admire about McArdle was her deep understanding of design as a tool for living, not just as a tool for consumption and making you feel like you have to follow the latest fashion. That wasn't her agenda. Her agenda was, how do I dress a woman for her real life? And it's an agenda we're still fighting it today, right? Because we've forgotten about McArdle and we've forgotten about a lot of her philosophies, and it's still hard to find clothes with pockets for women.
Near the top of this conversation, I made the assumption that your book, and because of how well it's doing, may change the trajectory of your career. So what's been your financial reality up to now? And is that about to change?
I don't think so. I don't think my reality will change. And here's what my reality has been. My reality has been that I've made my living as a freelance journalist and sometimes a staff journalist for much of my adult life, and my industry is imploding. So I have not had a per word count raise, meaning journalists like myself often get paid by the word. Mm-hmm. I haven't had a raise, quote unquote, in my rate since I was in my 20s, because the industry doesn't know how to pay writers anymore. I have written for arguably the top magazines in the world. I've written for The New Yorker. I've written for The New York Times. I've written for The Washington Post magazine. And I struggle with every month to make my bills. I do. I'm lucky because I'm able to afford my life, but I have not followed in the dream my parents had for me that I would do better than the next generation in a significantly different way. I am in great shape in a lot of ways, and I recognize my privilege, but I hustle and I work all the time. And it's only getting harder because many of the magazines I've written for, like the Washington Post magazine, is gone. It was shuttered.
Yeah.
We are in an era of massive disruption for many industries, and mine is one of them. I will say, you do not go into writing books to make money. It doesn't happen for most authors. It is very rare for an author to earn out their advance. So an advance is just what it sounds like. When you sign a book contract, you get a portion of money that they give you towards that book. As a nonfiction writer, I sold my book on proposal, which meant that I gave them a 100-page précis of like what I wanted this book to do. I gave them a very detailed outline. They bought that idea with the idea that I would write it, and they gave me an advance. That advance is paid out over 5 years, which means you don't get all the money up front, which means that the year and a half that I spent deeply researching and writing this book, I was pulling money out of my retirement savings to keep myself afloat. Not a smart budget financial decision. So the chances that this book, even as critically acclaimed as it is, will sell enough copies that I will ever see royalties is still pretty rare. Most books, I think 85% of books, don't quote me on that, but it's a high percentage, don't earn out their advance and don't sell more than 10,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And so do I hope I'll be lightning in a bottle and be an exception? Absolutely. Do I expect that to happen? No, it's luck. It's really luck if your book catches fire and you sell enough copies to make money off of it.
You've alluded to the scale of sales you would need to earn out. How much of that is, we're just weeks from your publication date. How much of that gets decided, say, within the first few weeks?
It's a great question. And I'm asking and learning all of these questions right along with you, because this is my first book. There's something called Book Scan, which is how bestsellers lists are tracked. And it's how you understand some sales numbers. So Book Scan is point of service sales. It's retailers, it's independent bookstores, and it's Amazon, it's places like that. And each week you get your book scan numbers. I haven't seen my book scan numbers for this week yet, so I don't know where I land. But an author can kind of see in real time some of the traction on sales. Those sales don't account for bulk orders to places like libraries or gift shops. So gift shops are tracked differently. So there's this interesting hierarchy of how sales are tracked in publishing. And then, of course, in your contract, you only make a certain percentage off of each sale that goes against your advance. And the more you sell, the first 5,000 books I sell, I think I get like 10% of that sale back towards my advance. I'd have to remind myself. If I sell more than 5,000, I think it goes up to 15%. So think about that too. It's not like the whole percentage of every book sale goes back towards counting against my advance. And so the first few months are really pivotal, because people and publishers feel like this is the moment where you're getting press, you're getting attention. And I've had to really kind of step back and create my own measurements for what does success mean to me. I wanted this book to be critically well received, and it has been. So in that way, I am successful. I wanted the family of Claire McCardle to feel proud of this book and to feel like I did right by Claire. I was successful in that. Yeah. I want to get Claire's story out to people and it resonates with them. Finding readers as a first-time author is a trick, right? Because we have so many attention-grabbing places to have that happen. Where do you put your time and your energy? And I think that what authors hear is what many of us hear. It's on you to do this. Find your audience. Do all the things. Hustle. And I think that we have to remember that there's only so much each of us can do individually to find our audiences. I'm remembering the value and necessity of rest in the process. I hope my book is a bestseller, of course, but I hope it sticks around. I hope that it keeps and continues to find audiences, and I will continue to cultivate those audiences for as long as this book is in print, because that's my goal. I don't want to be a flash in the pan. I want to be a book that people can continue to find for many years, and hopefully that can remain in print.
I've fallen into this myself. I'll have friends who do something that shows up in the news. They're getting a lot of attention. So that's a level of prestige and a level of prominence. I just assume that that is paired with a certain amount of financial stability. Is that something you end up discussing?
It's something I discuss with the right people who seem open to the conversation. I think some people right now very kindly and generously want to celebrate me. And I'm going to allow that celebration, meaning they're coming up to me super excited that they just saw me in the New York Times Book Review or The Atlantic. And I'm not going to undercut that moment by talking about the fact that that doesn't always translate into sales. But there are those I can tell really want to understand the reality, maybe because they want to be writers themselves or because they're just genuinely curious. And you're right. Our whole economic system in America is tethered to perception over reality. It's an influencer world where you've got this fake little snippet of a great life that you're portraying, but the reality of that life is very different. And I think that I've always wanted to dispel the myth and to talk about that gap between rhetoric and reality, not to be a bummer, but because I want to encourage more people to go into the arts with eyes wide open. I want more people writing. I want more people being creative. And the more that they are entering the field clouded by the mythology, the better the chances are they're going to be disillusioned and they're going to leave. And I don't want them to leave. I don't believe in a zero-sum game. I don't believe that because I'm in the Atlantic and you're not, I get more of the piece of the pie. I want us all in this world. And so it has been a mission of mine to talk to young writers about the very predatory contracts that are given out to writers. Mm-hmm. And to let them know that sometimes the goal isn't just to get the byline. You got to know what you're selling. You got to know what they're taking from you in order to get it. And now as a professor of writing at two universities here in Baltimore, I'm also grappling with my students over what AI means for them and for their future and how we have to be advocates on our behalf.
As I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking about our long history together. I don't remember ever having this conversation with you, but let's try it now. I want to go back to when we met. I'm from Baltimore. You were editor-in-chief at a magazine called Urbanite. And I just come back to the U.S. from the U.K. I was in grad school. I'm 25 years old. I knew I wanted to write, but I'd been too chicken to step out there. A former professor of mine and a family friend of yours, Matthew Crenson, introduced us. It led to a conversation, eventually ended up writing a piece for you all as a freelancer. I was scared to death. You were really kind and generous with your notes, but I looked at them with a lot of trepidation, like, how do I turn this around? Can I do it? Am I good enough? So I remember Urbanite and Elizabeth looking like a fantastic opportunity for me, but I was very green and very scared and afraid I might blow it. What was your experience working with me early on?
I saw an incredibly confident and ambitious young man who knew his heart and mind, even at that age. I really did. You're someone who, and we've talked about this in our private conversations, really worked hard to get to where you are. And I remember meeting you and immediately thinking to myself, like, here is a young man who's asking the right questions and who's deeply curious about the world. That's what I wanted more than anything, was to figure out how to create an infrastructure that would allow writers like you to find footing and maybe to get that chance to explore their thinking. I also remember at the time feeling badly about how busy I was and how much pressure was on me at the time to make this very small publication grow. I felt like I never was able to give each person enough time. That's how I felt. I felt like I was very busy. And I think I also was young and figuring it out. I was older than you, but I was new to editing. And I was trying to sort of grapple with that line between being professional and being personal. And I think that's always something that's an interesting challenge in any workplace. And I think it was not until you and I no longer worked together that we really were able to sort of come together in a much more deep friendship, because being a woman in a leadership position, I wasn't quite sure yet what that looked like. I never had a mentor. I never had anyone show me the way. I think one of the reasons you and I get along as well as we do is we ask the questions that are a little hard that not everybody wants to answer. But I think you and I are also often standing out on a limb, not really sure if that limb is going to hold.
I had no idea how much you were going through your own version of some of what I was grappling with.
We build these lives that are so compartmentalized, a lot of times by necessity. Mm-hmm. We can't integrate every person and every moment in our lives. But I think a lot about this idea of how much time we all spend at work and how lucky I am. Look, do I still worry about what my grocery bill is? 100%. But I also get to spend my days a little more integrated in what matters to me. And mm-hmm. my life, my quote unquote real life and my work life meld in a way that I don't think many of us in this country get. That's heartbreaking to me, because the thing I really wish for is I wish we didn't have healthcare tied to work. I wish we didn't have contracts that eviscerated young writers and artists. I wish that we could all live more integrated in how we work and how we live. Now we're at a place, Lionel, where our professional and our personal lives really dovetail. You and I can talk about anything. And yeah. It flows between personal life and work life because we understand that it's all one life. I ache right now for the ways in which our country has compartmentalized it more and more and divided us more and more intentionally.
It's such a balancing act. I started as a freelancer at Urbanite, and then I was hired as, again, you said it was a small publication. Indeed, it was. I was the very first person who worked there under the title staff writer. I started as an editorial assistant, grew a bit with the publication, made very little money, especially considering I had more than one master's degree at the point. I'd just come back from the UK. And that place was just really special to me. The importance of it and its positive impact on my life is totally disproportionate to the financial benefits I accrued at the time. But some of my closest friends I know from working at Urbanite, about 2013 or thereabout, Urbanite folded. But Freddie Gray, some people may recall, certainly if you're in Maryland, you do. He died in police custody. I believe he lived in East Baltimore, which is a big distinction in Baltimore, East versus West. And he ignited a lot of interest and passion around the issue of poverty, police brutality, and Black people and other people's interaction with the government in the form of police, and made national headlines. Urbanite was so needed by so many that, again, it was defunct. And we just came back together, mostly remotely on Slack, and figured out how to put together a special issue. I got to help us figure out like what the theme would be. The magazine rose from the dead for a special issue around truth and reconciliation. Let's imagine, inspired by processes like South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, what could that look like in Baltimore? Do we need it? Is it feasible? Let's start that thinking now. And it was amazing.
You knocked it out of the park with that issue, and it was important. And I think it's worth remembering that it was a quote unquote small publication in Baltimore, but at its audited readership was like 100,000. We had a lot of people reading that magazine. And I think that that's that idea of journalism and a magazine like that being the springboard into larger dialogues and larger conversations. And what I remember you doing with that issue was not just having it be about the magazine, but then where do we go from there? How do we have events? How do we have dialogue? And as we watch media conglomerate and disintegrate, we're losing those vital voices. In Baltimore now, we have things like the Baltimore Beat working to fill those gaps. It's frustrating because what we're losing are these vital voices and these vital perspectives.
Elizabeth, as you're talking, you've convinced me without your knowing it, you've convinced me that we have a pretty rampant and sophisticated vocabulary for assigning financial value and worth to things, but maybe not personal, moral, interpersonal, ethical value to things. I think it's certainly in the US, our vocabulary around there, that is pretty poor. And I don't read enough poetry, but the first thing I thought in terms of a space that is developing and cultivating that vocabulary is in poetry. I'm just curious what you think about my distinction that we know how to say how many pennies something is worth, but outside of that, not so much.
Oh, absolutely, right? Because we're capitalists. Like, we've been told that the only thing that's worth is monetary worth. And I think you're right. I mean, I often turn to the poets when I am in times of need, because talk about economy of thought and brilliance, the distillation of the poets to bring it home is something that has always served me and guided me well. I love this idea of coming up with a language of worth outside of capitalism and value. Mm. I realize as you're talking, I've done that without realizing it, because as a business owner, as my own business, every year I think about like my goal for the year. And usually that top goal is something like put myself in the path of new ideas. That was one goal I had. And then the financial goal is like, don't lose your house. Someone told me, Elizabeth, you have poverty thinking. They meant that I had this belief that I couldn't be wealthy because I was told a writer can never be wealthy, or I grew up in a family where that was the message. I've really been interrogating that idea of poverty thinking, because I think, to your point, it extends beyond your bank account.
Yeah.
Because to me, I'm wealthy in all the ways that matter. I've got friends like you. I've got a family that cares. I've got readers, doesn't matter how many. I've got readers who are writing me and saying this book deeply affected me. And that's really what I wanted. And so I love this idea of how do we start to put language around the value of a life that has nothing to do with your bank account. It's hard to do when you're struggling just to survive. And again, I am not struggling just to survive. I am okay. But I think so many of us don't have the luxury of getting to take stock and value of our lives, because we're in a fight, flight, freeze moment of culture and politics and reality that keep us hungry and chasing and scared. Let's start coming up with those words. Let's make our own words.
Done deal. We're going to do that. Before we wrap, I've been experimenting. So I've got that standard question at the top. What's your money origin story? And I've been experimenting recently with a few other standard questions as a nice point of comparison across some of the interviews. So I'll just hit you with a few of those before we close. Is there something, beginning when you were a kid, that you really wanted but feared you might never be able to afford?
Being a writer. I always wanted to be a writer, and I didn't think I'd be able to afford it.
You did it.
I did it. I did it.
Another question in that vein. If you did not need money at all, would you be doing something different with your life? And if so, what might that be?
If I didn't need money, I would absolutely have more time to volunteer. And I am particularly in this moment with a child heading into public high school, thinking a lot about, you know, wanting to fight for public education, wanting to fight for public libraries. I would absolutely, if I wasn't as busy as I am just keeping going, I would volunteer a lot more.
One of my hopes with having conversations like this and then making them available to other people is that those thoughts, those ideas, those hopes can inspire other people. You're doing what you can. Maybe you inspire 10, 100, 1,000 people who might hear this one day to do a bit more. I believe in that multiplier effect.
I believe in it too. I think we're both examples of two people who have a very broad and interesting community of people in our lives, in part because we do try just to put it out there in the world and see what comes back.
Well, Elizabeth, I was very fortunate at one point to call you my boss. I love it even more that I get to call you a friend. Thank you.
The feeling is mutual. It was so great being here today, Lionel. I love talking to you.
Same here. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Music for Money Honestly is courtesy of bassist, composer, and band leader Chris Funn. It's his song Wish from the album Corner Store. You know, Money Honestly has a newsletter now. I didn't get too creative with the title. It's called The Honest Newsletter, but it's good. You can sign up now at LionelFoster.com.